From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, coverage of the 2012 Summer Olympics is inescapable. It's essentially a 16-day Super Bowl, and the TV viewership has been huge. On average, 35.6 million Americans per night. That beats 2008 in Beijing or 2004 in Athens by millions. In fact, to find a non-U.S. Summer Olympics that got more American viewers, you have to go back to 1976 in Montreal. It's unlikely this year's TV ratings will surpass Montreal's because, one, there are now a zillion other viewing options, and two, NBC can't beat the clock. London is 5 hours ahead of New York, limiting what NBC can broadcast live in prime time. NBC has offered cable subscribers the ability to stream events live online, but viewers who want broadcast quality and high production values are stuck with the tape delays, which has led to a kind of a battle. On one side, viewers and critics accustomed to watching TV when and how they want to. On the other, NBC, which wants to maximize the ad revenue that pays for all the coverage. Time magazine TV critic James Poniewozik has written about this quandary. Jim, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
The Onion had a headline this week that read, NBC on Olympics coverage. Sorry we didn't alter the laws of time and space to accommodate people's schedules. You're one of the critics who wished they had. What's your beef?
It's absolutely true. One cannot reasonably expect NBC to air live Olympic events in American prime time because that is the middle of the early morning in London. But what NBC could easily do and chooses not to is air the most anticipated events, the ones that they know their viewers most want to watch, live, and then air them again in prime time when more people have a chance to watch it. So when NBC holds back a big event from you all day and you wait hours and hours and hours to find out who's going to win the women's swimming competition, and then NBC shows you 5 minutes before they air the race.
Coming up, how good can Missy Franklin be tonight? Finals of the 100 back coming up.
When you're 17 years old and win your first gold medal, there's nobody you'd rather share it with. A Today exclusive, live from London tomorrow.
You know, they reap the fallout from that. NBC does air live Olympic coverage from London. Water polo, judo. If you're slightly interested in watching it, they may be willing to show it to you live. If you're very interested in watching it, they want to make sure that you wait until prime time if you want to see it on your big screen TV.
They make a whole lot more money by showing the most popular events in prime time where the audiences are vastly larger.
Yeah, they want to collect as many eyeballs as they can in their most lucrative day part because they're a business and they've got a lot of bills to pay, including a multi-billion dollar bill for airing the Olympics to begin with. And here's the funny thing. NBC is deliberately airing all its events live over the internet. And NBC isn't making this stuff available just out of the goodness of its hearts. They and other networks have found that with live events, when you have people watching them early, say an award ceremony that airs live to the East Coast and taped to the West Coast, the fact that some people see it first and are spoiling it and buzzing about it and tweeting about it, that over and over again has seemed to actually goose and increase numbers for the events.
It seems to me that one way or another, this is kind of a pivotal moment in the evolution of broadcast television. On the one hand, viewers have grown accustomed to being able to determine the time and place of their viewing. On the other hand, NBC seems to be kind of sticking to the old model of dictating what you're going to get when you're going to get it.
It's just a classic case of something that we see more and more often now, which is a mismatch between the capabilities of media today and the business model. NBC, you know, like a lot of media companies, has the capability of bringing you the Olympics in a 21st century way, on your schedule, where you want to watch it. But they only really know how to make money off of it the 20th century way. And so as much as possible, they have to try to compel you into that framework. So while there have always been people who didn't like tape delay, now you have this disparity between what you know NBC could do and what NBC is actually doing. And it just makes for a more and more adversarial model of business. And NBC is relying on things like Twitter and Facebook and so on to build buzz for their games, which has paid off in the ratings, but it also creates this tremendous echo chamber for anybody who wants to complain about it.
There's one more thing I want to ask you. With this gigantic audience that it's assembled in prime time, NBC has said publicly, we might even break even. They have invested billions of dollars in the Olympics contract over the years. Why have they made this investment if they don't even think they're going to break even?
Well, there are all sorts of ancillary benefits to a big media company like NBC. It raises their profile to have the Olympics. And there are things like promotional benefits, which, you know, NBC hopes anyway that it's going to be promoting a lot of new NBC fall shows, say, on the Olympics this summer, and then have them turn out to be hits in the fall. Now, I would say that one of the last times NBC tried to do this was in 2004, where its big potential primetime hits were Father of the Pride and Joey, which, as we all know, are now triumphantly going into their ninth seasons. So, you know, look for magic to happen again.
Jim, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Bob.
James Poniewozik is TV critic for Time magazine. The Onion's writers couldn't resist one more headline about the NBC Olympics. Michael Phelps asks Bob Costas if he wins or loses tonight. This Olympic week was ideal for Onion-esque absurdity. An Olympic celebration choreography malfunction left London's mayor suspended from a zip wire holding tiny British flags. Multiple badminton teams were suspended for not trying hard enough. Each one of these stories prompts the refrain, "It sounds like an Onion headline." The Onion, of course, is the satirical paper of fake news, but an Onion headline isn't just absurdity. As a public service, we called in former Onion Features editor Joe Garden to help us walk through the difference between an odd headline and an Onion headline. Joe, welcome to the show.
Hi, Bob. Great to be here.
Now, here's a couple more we saw this week. One, Chick-fil-A public relations boss dies amid homophobia uproar. And one from an NPR story, ever-growing past confounds history teachers.
Is that seriously a story, or is that, am I being put on?
Evidently, from NPR's website.
I'm upping my pledge money. That's totally worth it.
Why is one of these a prospective Onion headline and one not?
Inasmuch as I may disagree with Chick-fil-A, I don't wish death on any of them. And so the idea that their publicist died amidst this very stressful time, it's almost like it's just chicken. It's not worth dying over. The ever-growing past, that could totally be an Onion story. We did something sort of similar, like U.S. Department of Retro warns we're running out of decades.
Sounds like an old Bazooka Joe joke or something like that.
Right. You know, more it's like, the problem with history is it just keeps happening. We keep making more. And then Bazooka Joe is falling backwards and his feet fly up in the air. Oh, no.
Now, when you worked at The Onion, I'm going to take a wild guess that your inbox was just constantly filled with torn from the real headlines headlines with the comment that you could have written this. Did they ever get it right?
Usually not. It would always be something that was just a little bit too broad and slapsticky. President Obama falls down the stairs. That wasn't really what we were striving for. We were striving more for satire. Just because something silly happened, it didn't mean it made a greater point at all. The hard thing was when you're sort of cornered at a party and somebody pitches you a news event that they think would be a great Onion headline, and then you sort of have to be like, ah, ha, ha, ha. Oh, yeah, well, I'll get right on that. Yeah. And then you sort of like try to
frozen
change it.
Frozen smile. Is there an underlying rubric for putting these together?
What The Onion tries to do mostly is react to more of a zeitgeist rather than specific news event. I mean, that's why a lot of The Onion stories hold up still, you know, 5, 10, 15 years later, is because it wasn't really reactive to one specific story. I think people really don't understand that it takes more than just a goofy series of circumstances put in headline form. You know, you're actually trying to form a decent cohesive joke that makes a point in as few words as possible. It's not just somebody getting stuck on a zip line. Although that's a comical image, it's not a great headline.
Now, there's actually an inverse of this phenomenon, or reverse, converse, or possibly reciprocal. I'm not sure what the analogy is mathematically, but that is the headline that is so perfect in its fakeness that it fakes out people who think it's actually real.
Mm-hmm. The Onion reported that Congress was threatening to leave Washington, D.C. unless they built a new Capitol building, complete with a retractable dome for daylight legislation.
Like the Nets.
Yes, or... and we even had our own architectural drawing of the building, and they, Beijing Evening News, picked it up and ran it, complete with our graphic. And then when a reporter called them and said, you know, this is made up, right? Their response was, well, how do you know it's made up?
Now, it doesn't take a Chinese news agency to do that. Some percentage of the public is irony impaired, you know, and it might be 70. Do you just have regular civilians writing to you in outrage over some headline that they have taken to be the real deal?
Yeah, to me, the best example of that was an op-ed. It was, Mary Kate is holding Ashley Olsen down. And this is still when they were, like, young. And every week, you could kind of getting five or six angry emails for about 2 years about that article.
All right, Joe. So lastly, we have this idea of throwing it out to our listeners. And we want to find out whether OTM fans can themselves find an Onion-esque headline in the wild. And then, if you're willing, we'll bring you back. And you can choose the best, and then someone will win one of our deeply fantastic On Caffeine mugs. What do you think?
I love that.
Joe, thanks so much.
Thank you, Bob.
Joe Garden is the former features editor of The Onion. Here are some Onion video headlines for inspiration for listeners hoping to find one that'll impress Joe.
Where Gmail servers were down for nearly 2 hours today in what Google called a show of their immense power.
The nation's girlfriends continue to press for an economic recovery plan they say could save the nation as much as $220 billion annually if their boyfriends simply agree to move in with them.
Congress today passed a landmark Social Security reform bill they estimate could save the troubled program billions. The so-called Grab Life by the Balls bill includes provisions to cut the cost of cigarettes in half, outlaws helmets, and adjusts the CDC's recommended amount of sleep from 8 hours a night to when you're dead.
Coming up, was Romney's old business private equity or venture capital? The media are confused. You don't have to be.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the Internet. More at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. On the heels of Mitt Romney's swing through the outside world, now the political conversation swings back to jobs. Who makes them? Who breaks them? And which Bain Capital, which Romney co-founded in 1984, did or does? The debate goes back to the start of the campaign season. Here's what former House Speaker and erstwhile Republican presidential candidate Newt Gingrich said.
I would just say that if Governor Romney would like to give back all the money he's earned from bankrupting companies and laying off employees over his years at Bain, that I would be glad to then listen to him.
And here's what Texas governor and erstwhile Republican presidential candidate Rick Perry said.
Venture capitalists are good. They go in, they inject their capital, they create jobs. Bain Capital, on the other hand, it appears to me, were vulture capitalists all too often.
Most times, Bain Capital and Romney's work in it is grouped under the private equity heading. Other times, Romney is referred to as a venture capitalist and Bain Capital as a venture capital firm. The Daily News has done that. So has the Christian Science Monitor, NPR, CNN, and even The Daily Show.
By nature, Mitt Romney is a venture capitalist. What he did for a living is competed with these governments.
More than a third of registered voters said Romney's tenure at the venture capital firm Bain Capital made their view of him less favorable.
The hot political story of the moment is Mitt Romney's old venture capital company.
But Emily Mendel, vice president of communications at the National Venture Capital Association, the lobbying group for the venture capital industry, doesn't like it.
Every morning I get a list of clips that are following the campaign. And when I see a clip where a journalist, usually a political pundit, mischaracterizes Mitt Romney's investments as venture capital, I send a really nice note to that reporter. It's very straightforward and explains the difference between venture capital and private equity. Venture capital starts and builds new companies from scratch. Private equity comes in and turns around mature companies. So companies that are having financial problems, need capital infusion, need a different strategy. It is a high-risk business, as it is in venture capital. So when a company closes, jobs are lost.
For you, most of Romney's work for Bain Capital should be characterized as private equity, right? Even though Bain Capital has done some venture capital investing.
Romney did do some venture capital investments and did create jobs. But you are correct. The majority of investing he did while he was at Bain Capital would be considered private equity.
So why do you feel the need to get back to journalists who make this mistake?
Because of the current political climate, there are going to be many people out there who are trying to attack Mitt Romney as a private equity professional, and they're going to say that he killed jobs. Now, whether or not you believe that, he was not a venture capitalist, and we don't want any policymakers to become confused that venture capital isn't creating jobs and isn't fostering innovation.
Give me an example of what happens when venture capitalists get confused with private equity people.
One in particular is Dodd-Frank. Legislators put venture capital, private equity, hedge funds onto a similar bucket and said, we need to make sure that these companies register with the SEC so that we avoid any future systemic financial risk. And you have to remember that venture capital firms are largely very, very small partnerships with, you know, maybe 8 to 10 people. They don't have the resources to afford the SEC registration process. So we went to work talking with legislators about the fact that venture capital does not create systemic financial risk. We don't trade derivatives. We don't use leverage or debt. And ultimately, they carved us out of Dodd-Frank legislation.
Is it awkward going through this process? I know you don't want to throw your financial industry brethren in private equity under a bus.
We don't want to throw private equity under the bus. Private equity has contributed a great deal to the U.S. economy, but that's not our story to tell. Our story to tell is the venture capital story.
So, would you want to jump at this point from representing venture capital to representing private equity?
I represent the white hats in the industry. I never worry about putting any of my venture capital members in front of any reporter because they have such a compelling story to tell. Venture capitalists are so smart and so engaged and so dedicated to building companies and helping entrepreneurs. You know, I never back down from a challenge, but I think the private equity folks have a tremendous challenge ahead of them, and I certainly wish them the best of luck.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Emily Mendel is Vice President of Communications at the National Venture Capital Association. Daniel Gross is a columnist and global business editor at Newsweek Daily Beast. Daniel, welcome back to the show.
It's good to be here.
Okay, so what is the difference between private equity and venture capital? Lay it out neat and sweet.
So venture capital is cool. These are people in California who wear khakis and maybe blazers. They invest in technology companies, biotech, clean technology, alternative energy.
Where do they get their money?
They start with their own money or they raise a fund. They'll go to pension funds and insurance companies, rich individuals, university endowments and say, we'll take your money and we will spread it around among startup companies. We will provide them with money and with expertise and advice. They understand a fair number of them will fail, as a lot of dot-coms did, but that when you really strike it rich, then you can get a return of 20, 30, 40 times, and that can make their fund worth a lot of money over time.
So now move on to private equity.
Oh. This is a East Coast New York phenomenon. These guys are former bankers. They wear suits. They look around for existing companies that may have run into trouble or that are having problems growing or that, you know, they don't have a lot of debt so they could stand to take on a lot of debt. Hotel companies, casino companies, restaurants, companies that make widgets. And they will go and buy that company using a lot of debt to do so. If it makes sense to invest and grow the company to a larger size, they will do it. But their goal is to get a return by selling the company down the road or by having the company issue debt and pay themselves a dividend. If the company is doing poorly, they will let the company go bankrupt and default on its obligations to bondholders or workers. And that's accepted in that industry. It doesn't stop the banks from lending to these people in the future because, you know, on the aggregate, they do pay back their debt.
We've talked about how the media sometimes refer to Bain Capital and Romney as being in the venture capital business. Are they wrong?
Bain was something of a hybrid. Bain Capital did, in some instances, invest in very small companies that later became quite large. Sports Authority, Staples is the example that he likes to use the most. When Staples came across their desk, it was a very small company, and with their investment, it grew much larger. That is much more typical of a venture capital investment. On the other hand, they did a lot of traditional private equity deals where they would go acquire an existing company, frequently loaded up with debt to pay themselves a dividend. Some of those went bankrupt. And you see these in the negative ads, some of these steel companies, industrial companies, where the workers came out quite poorly. Those are really traditional private equity firms. So I think Bain is really a hybrid, probably more a private equity firm than a venture capital firm. But certainly for Romney's purposes, he would much rather present himself to the public as a venture capitalist than as a private equity guy.
So there's a lot of attention on it during this political campaign. You think this is a fake issue, a red herring, or do you think it's relevant?
No, I think it's a very real issue. Romney does not talk much about his tenure as governor of Massachusetts. His primary selling point is that he was a businessman, and the type of businessman he was primarily a private equity investor. So if you think that what he learned from private equity is translatable and what the economy at large needs, then he's saying you should vote for him. But private equity rolls in a sort of fundamentally different way than a lot of different businesses. They can make money even as the company fails. That's part of the culture of the business. That is not so much the culture of our political system today. I mean, you're going to have two counter-narratives. One is the Obama campaign wants to present Romney as a private equity guy with all the negative connotations of that, right? They run companies into the ground. They profit even as the companies falter. They rely on this wrinkle in the tax code. It's not sort of real business. It's just financial engineering. And Romney wants to present himself as a venture guy, someone who helps other people grow. It's not a matter of a zero-sum game, but it's really about enlarging the pie, creating jobs, et cetera. Now, they may not use these terms, I'm a venture capitalist, no, you're a private equity person, but that's in effect the difference that we're talking about.
All right. Dan, thank you very much.
Anytime.
Daniel Gross is a columnist and global business editor at Newsweek Daily Beast.
With the death last week of Sally Ride, the first American woman in space, the world learned something new about the pioneering astronaut, that Dr. Ride was, in fact, a lesbian, survived by her partner of 27 years, a woman by the name of Tam O'Shaughnessy. This previously unknown detail of Ride's life was mentioned in one line at the end of a lengthy obituary in the New York Times. Reaction to the Times obit ranged from criticism for posthumously outing Ride to criticism for not outing her enough, raising the question of just how deeply an obituary should delve into the private lives of public people. Bill McDonald is the obituary editor at the New York Times. Bill, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
Now, the obit didn't reference her sexual preference. It just simply made reference to her longtime partner, who happens to be a woman.
That's right. When we were trying to find out who her survivors might be, the only information we could go on was a statement released on her website, which described Dr. O'Shaughnessy as her companion of 27 years. And of course, we reported that. You know, in the best of all worlds, if we had some more time to do it, we might have tried to reach Dr. O'Shaughnessy and talk to her about their work together and about their relationship. But we had very difficult time trying to reach anyone. It was simply a matter of deadline pressure, the logistics of newspapering, and nothing more than that.
The reason we're having this conversation is because the question of sexual preference, in many ways, for public figures, is not a personal matter. It has been heavily politicized. Uh-huh. There's some pressure from gay rights organizations for people living in the public eye, uh-huh, if they're gay, to let the world know, to uh-huh, not be closeted. If you've chosen in your private life to remain private, uh-huh, should that be respected upon your death?
We don't go out of our way to describe or talk about sexuality unless there was a reason to, unless the person involved made an issue of it. hypothetically, you know, if a politician had said some homophobic things or had supported some legislation that would penalize gay Americans, and then we find out that that politician had been gay himself or something like that, then that's fair game. That's an issue then that that person was very public about. So in that case, we would have no qualms.
Historically, the Times and other newspapers have had a sort of a vocabulary of euphemism for describing the domestic arrangements of people who were not publicly out. Can you give me some examples of the phraseology that would be employed?
Longtime companion was one. And probably when I started at this newspaper in the late 80s, early 90s, that era and before, the paper was less comfortable and probably did use those kinds of locutions, which are clumsy. And I think the news industry has evolved.
You don't see confirmed bachelor in the pages of the New York Times.
You don't see confirmed bachelor, exactly. We don't have to use those now. Where people were much less inclined to be public, now they are, and we can be therefore more public because we are essentially reporting what's on the public record. There's always a line you have to navigate between privacy and public information and public interest.
I suppose we should actually mention here the difference between an obituary and a death notice.
The death notice is an advertisement. It's paid for by the family or someone close to them. And it is their take on the individual, and it's often a tribute, really. But what we're doing is journalism.
When you've just died, there tends to be respect and delicacy lent to your memory. But journalism, strictly speaking, does not have to participate in that convention either.
No, it doesn't. And we do not withhold information that we think is useful to help portray a person. Families often request that we don't report this or that. And if it's on the public record and it's part of that person's life, we can't respect that. That runs against our conventions of journalism.
Can I ask you one hypothetical?
Mm-hmm.
Let's just say that I've been living for 35 years with not one spouse, but two, just for argument's sake. And let's say that I'm a complete civilian. Nobody knows me except for 38 years ago, I invented artificial cork. So the reason you're writing about me in the obit section is because I am the inventor of artificial cork, but I just had that one brief moment in the public spotlight and have lived in obscurity ever since. What do you do about the living arrangements that I have assiduously worked to keep private for decades?
We have many obituaries like that, in fact, you know, where someone had their moment many years ago and became essentially private citizens afterwards. I think Sally Ride, in many ways, was that kind of individual. In this hypothetical example, we would write about that invention. We would then ask the family who the survivors are. Now, if that family member discloses that the individual was living with two other people from the opposite sex and wanted to leave it at that, we would report that. But I would suspect that if it were a very private matter, that someone wouldn't even be telling us that.
Bill, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Bill McDonald is the obituary editor at the New York Times. Weeks ago, we reported on a stunning revelation in the New York Times of a practice employed by the New York Times and most other news organizations with a Washington presence called quote approval, an extension of the common, albeit sketchy, practice of on-background interviews. It puts reporters in the position of submitting interview quotes back to the source who determines whether and in what form they may appear. Far be it from us to characterize this conduct as a shameful, craven, degrading surrender of independence and virtual conspiracy of subterfuge. So we asked media ethicist Edward Wasserman to weigh in.
I think at this point, you're no longer talking about an interview, you're talking about a press release. And what happens is Washington becomes no different from Beijing in terms of reporting what authorities want reported.
Yeah, what he said. To add insult to injury, a Washington Post reporter was outed as having not only shared proposed quotes with sources, but an entire draft of a story on Texas education standards to officials of the University of Texas. The backlash was swift. Post executive editor Marcus Brauchle was obliged to issue new ethics guidance for his staff,
absolutely and unequivocally forbidding quote approval and draft sharing. Unless, you know, it's convenient. Quoting Brockley here, "We should not allow sources to change what was said in an original interview, although accuracy or the risk of losing an on-the-record quote from a crucial source may sometimes require it. A better and more acceptable alternative is to permit a source to add to a quotation and then explain that sequence to readers. As someone once said, you can't make this stuff up." Anyway, enter the Washington Bureau of McClatchy Newspapers. Bureau Chief Jim Asher also issued a communique on the subject. He offered it to his readers. Quote, "I make this commitment to our readers and to our citizens. McClatchy journalists will report fairly and independently. We will not make deals with those in power, regardless of party or philosophy." Independence for the Washington Press Corps. What an odd and splendid idea. And you can quote me on that. But let me see it first.
Coming up, when it comes to ads and their use of pop songs, imitation isn't a form of flattery. It's more like larceny.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the Internet. More at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org. And the SCAN Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence. At thescanfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Over the past 2 years, a global pact meant to curb online piracy in the trade of counterfeit goods, called the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, or ACTA, has been negotiated in secret. Now we know the penalties considered for even minor violations were severe, including the seizure of websites, policing by internet service providers, and even banishment from the net if accused three times of illegal downloading, even if the charges aren't proved. Meanwhile, copycat bills, such as the Senate's Stop Online Piracy Act, or SOPA, and its House counterpart, PIPA, were introduced and then killed after public uproar. Now it seems ACTA may be breathing its last. While 9 countries and 22 EU member states have signed on, none have yet ratified it. And last month, the EU Parliament soundly rejected it. We asked Harvard Law professor Jonathan Zittrain if ACTA is dead. And he said, well, like Frankenstein's monster is dead.
Somewhere between dead and undead, with various constituent parts of it able to be sewn on to other creatures. We had Mexico in 2010, the Senate there unanimously voted to remove itself from the ACTA negotiations. And then you end up with, just this month, the Mexican Institute for the Industrial Property announced that Mexico had signed ACTA in Tokyo through its ambassador. Now, that's something that still would have to be ratified, but it's very interesting to see these sort of internal disagreements, like the European Parliament versus the European Commission, the Mexican Senate versus the Mexican Institute. There's not even unanimity within governments about what to do about this.
And do we have to ratify it here, or do we just enact it piece by piece while nobody's looking?
That may well be a strategy. There are people looking, and we saw this month the announcement of something called the Internet Defense League, which has its own cat signal. A cute cat is projected into the sky trying to summon the masses of the internet. I think they did it on the Bay Bridge in San Francisco to start. They'll keep an eye out and then try to summon the masses when there's a problem. And of course, you can get fatigued. You can get exhausted again and again trying to beat this back in every form.
You have SOPA and PIPA and ACTA and TPP and CETA. This is the Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement that is being hammered out between EU and Canada. Isn't that the latest?
Yes. And from as much as we can tell, again, this is all through leaked texts, the CETA, which is nearing completion, had been pulling back on some of its similarities to ACTA. So it's removing a hand here and a foot there. But again, we don't know what's in it until it suddenly is dropped upon everybody for ratification. But this is just no way to make the sausage.
What do you think is worse, the provisions within these treaties or the way that they're being hammered out?
The law professor in me says it's the process foul. Mm-hmm. It's the attempt to do this without the best disinfectant, which is sunshine. And if there is the sunshine and you have a process that's more open, you really will have geeks who are keeping an eye on things. They'll raise the alarm if they see something that worries them. There'll be a discussion about it. We'll see if people are rallied about it. And that's how you do things in a democracy.
Are you readying a cat signal in Boston?
I'm scanning the skies, waiting to see if the call goes out. Yes.
Jonathan, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Brooke.
Jonathan Zittrain is a professor at Harvard Law School and at the School of Engineering and Applied Sciences. The new novel Year Zero, a science fiction comic romp, considers the cosmic implications of our copyright laws. It begins in 1972 with the Pioneer 10 probe, the first spacecraft to achieve escape velocity from the solar system. That's when the, quote, refined league of the universe's extraterrestrials first noticed us and began to tune into our broadcasts. Now, the refined league worships artistic endeavor, and most revered of all the arts is music. But as it turns out,
aliens suck at music.
Rob Reed is the author of Year Zero. We'll be hearing some bits from the audiobook read by John Hodgman. But first, back to those aliens. They had music, and they thought it was pretty good. Until
they heard ours. And the reason isn't so much that their music is terrible. It's more that our music is that good. And then when the aliens do hear their first human song, and it's the theme song to Welcome Back, Kotter, they believe they are hearing the greatest creative achievement since the dawn of time itself.
The universe convulses.
The delight triggered by the Kotter song released so much endorphin-like goo in their brains that they hemorrhaged, bringing on immediate ecstatic death. Welcome back, welcome back, welcome back.
Soon they discovered the top 40 stations of the AM spectrum, and they listened to Staying Alive by the Bee Gees, Seasons in the Sun by Terry Jacks, and the immortal Boogie Oogie Oogie by A Taste of Honey. More rhapsodic joy, more hemorrhaging brains.
The last big die-off occurred when WPLJ broadcast both sides of Led Zeppelin IV, and anyone who survived that had what it took to safely listen to even the most stellar rock and roll. Alien anthropologists began studying other aspects of human society, and that's when it hit them. They owed us an ungodly amount of money,
which would bankrupt the entire universe many times over. Could you explain how our copyright laws almost result in the annihilation of the planet?
For reasons that are baked deep into the plot, the aliens are obligated to honor our copyright laws. And this is a problem because, as it turns out, the United States has the most onerous copyright laws ever created by any society anywhere in the universe since the Big Bang. The key manifestation of this is the $150,000 maximum fine that a person can be liable for pirating a single copy of a single song.
And this isn't fiction.
That is not fiction. It is called the Copyright Damages Improvement Act. And tens of thousands of American citizens have, in fact, been sued under that very law.
Tell me about Nick Carter.
Nick Carter is our hero, and like so many great action heroes, he is a low-level copyright lawyer. He is chosen by the aliens to be their champion on Earth. They find that the most powerful media law firm on Earth is called Carter, Geller & Marx, and there's a young man there named Nick Carter. And they're like, great, the Backstreet Boy, right? So they come down to this Nick Carter, and of course, he's not the Backstreet Boy. He's just a low-level copyright attorney who happens to have the same very common last name as the guy who started the firm.
Now, you have a great character in the book, a lawyer named Judy Sherman, who's one of the heads of your protagonist's firm.
Yes.
Is she based on a real character?
She actually isn't. I can't even say that she's a composite of a bunch of people that I know. She's just this terrifying, exhilarating force of white-collar nature who is ruthlessly great at her job, and her job is to make sure that the legal environment is hospitable as possible to the music industry.
Now, I asked you if she was real only because you have another character referred to in the text as Senator Fido, who does yes. Judy's bidding like an obedient poodle, but you fleetingly identify him in the footnote as Orrin Hatch.
Yes, indeed. Now, this character fancies himself to be a songwriter, and so music industry lobbyists like Judy are able to manipulate him by playing to this little fantasy of his. And from my own interactions with him over the years, I accrued quite a collection of Orrin Hatch CDs, actually. And it is firmly believed in certain circles that the music industry lobbyists have played to Mr. Hatch's songwriting pretensions to great effect.
At one of Judy's staff meetings where she solicits ways to extend the copyright law, somebody suggests having copyright infringement classified as terrorism.
She's goading her minions to come up with new ways to profiteer from different laws that are on the books. And our hero, Nick Carter, goes through this cockamamie idea about how a change to the Patriot Act could end up putting file sharing right in the same category as dirty bombs and other horrible things. Then Judy seems to denounce him for having such a sick and twisted idea, only to reveal at the end of her faux denunciation that they've already tried it a couple of times.
Rob, I see in your bio that you were one of the first Harvard MBAs to specialize in internet studies. You founded one of the earliest digital music sites, Listen.com. Was this a fever dream of revenge?
No. As I started crafting a storyline around this core notion of aliens loving our music, I realized, hey, I know something that's really hysterical when you think about it, which is our copyright law. From all these years that I spent working in online music, I unfortunately did not meet any aliens, though.
Rob, thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
Rob Reed is the author of Year Zero. A few months ago, Volkswagen released an ad in the UK for the VW Polo. This spot fits the VW formula. Gauzy images of cute young families, Helvetica-esque subtitles, and of course, pitch-perfect music. DDB, the ad firm behind the VW spot, had asked to use a song by the indie band Beach House. The band said no, but the song that ran in the ad sounded very, very similar to the Beach House song Take Care. How similar? Here's Beach House. Stay beside me, can hide the rainmaker. The practice of ad companies creating Xeroxes of pop songs is a time-honored tradition. So time-honored, in fact, that Bob looked into it during the primordial days of our show back in 2001. The victim back then, Sheryl Crow.
I'm not really much into pop music.
That's hard to believe.
I know, but I've been doing some research, and now I'm like totally hep to the cruche of what platters the young kids are grooving on.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, some voices are so distinctive that even I recognize them. Your Jimmy Durantes, your Bee Gees, your Joe Cockers, your Yannis, and of course, currently, your Sheryl and the Crows.
And your Sheryl Crow.
Whatever. Just listen. Chevrolet, America's waiting for you to call. If you're thinking, what's Sheryl Crow doing singing ad jingles? The answer is, that isn't her. It's simply someone who sounds an awful lot like Sheryl Crow, with a melody much like Sheryl Crow's and instrumentation much like Sheryl Crow's. In other words, a sound alike. You don't hear many of them these days because back in 1992, when Lincoln Mercury used a sound alike of Midler singing Do You Wanna Dance, the divine Miss M sued the pants off the ad agency. Since then, blatant vocal knockoffs have wound up costing ad agencies and clients big court awards and legal settlements, but that doesn't mean there are no sound-alikes in commercials. Because if you think about it, most advertising music isn't vocal, it's instrumental.
Seems like they were thinking about it from the beginning.
In the 1930s, they built their first safety test vehicle.
They patented safety door locks in 1949.
They conducted their first rollover test in 1959.
That was a TV commercial for Mercedes. Now listen to this track. It's a song called Porcelain by a performer called Moby.
I can sit there and watch any of the major networks every night, and you know, I can hear it. I can hear where they came from, and I can bet you I could go back and find an early cut of that commercial that had that track on it.
Chris McHale is a composer, musician, and president of the McHale Barone Audio Agency.
These days, the editors like to work with music when they're editing the picture to kind of give them a rhythmic impulse for the editing. And, you know, the editing process might take 2 or 3 weeks, so the editor might put a piece of music on a commercial as a scratch track to edit to, actually cut the picture to.
And what happens is a phenomenon called demo love.
Josh Rabinowitz is a music producer at Young & Rubicam Advertising in New York.
The people, the creatives and the producers and sometimes the clients that are sitting in on these editing sessions, they fall in love with it because it's something they've grown accustomed to listening to.
Which would be fine, except in all likelihood, the agency and its clients have no rights to use whatever music they were editing to. This leaves three options. One is to try to obtain the song from the original artists. This is always expensive and sometimes futile because artists don't necessarily want to sell. The second is to compose or obtain wholly different music, but the pictures are already edited to the demo. The third option is to go to a music production house and commission a piece which is similar enough to the original to satisfy demo love, but different enough that the lawsuits don't start flying. In the euphemism of his trade, Rabinowitz calls these similarities references or citations.
There's some groups that people often cite, especially recently, Moby being one. Moby's actually sold a lot of his tracks to corporations for ads. Another person is Danny Elfman, seems to get a lot of play.
Well, let's see. One more time, here's Moby. And here's referenced Moby, this time in an ad for DLJ Online Brokerage. Pretty brazen and pretty simple, too. They basically just changed the key. But while that may be easy work for advertising music composers, that doesn't mean they like it.
It's sort of like they're hiring our hands and not our head.
Steve Curran, who runs Harvest Music in Lansing, Michigan, dies a little inside every time a client walks in to file the serial number off of somebody else's song. Luckily, Curran says, it only happens every single week.
We get a call from the producer or creative director on the project, and they say, we never intended to use it, but we really like this piece of music. What do you think? What do you think about what? What do you think about getting close to that? Can we get close to that? No, we can't get close to that. Well, why not? Well, because we'll get sued. Okay, but can we get kind of close to it anyway?
So pervasive is this practice, and so great is the legal risk, that advertising agencies are reduced to consulting people like Matt Harris, a professional musicologist, to certify that ad citations aren't actually larceny.
It's not always a matter of the notes. I mean, whatever is significant.
The standard trick of the trade is to change keys or alter the melody without disrupting the rhythmic structure. But Harris says that doesn't always work either.
I mean, like in rap music, there is no melody, there's no harmony usually. So then you look at the drums, you see what the drums are doing. Even I listen to if somebody has a very special kind of reverb or echo. I mean, all these little telltale signs that somebody is really after something, trying to get something that they can't have.
How much leeway an advertiser has depends somewhat on how shrewd he is or surreptitious. If, for instance, the agency tries to get rights to the song that everybody fell in love with and gets turned down, as Doritos once did with a Tom Waits song, the subsequently commissioned music had better sound very, very different. But the sound-alike radio commercial broke. Waits said, "That's Nacho property," sued, and Doritos got crunched $2.4 million worth.
As irony would have it, the song in question was Step Right Up, a wicked satire of the commercial culture. One of the more memorable lyrics, Don't Be Fooled by Cheap Imitations. It forges your signature. Not completely satisfied. Mail back on you. Portion of product for complete refund of price of punches. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, DJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Amy DePiro and Eliza Novick-Smith, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.